Unit 2 was going to do just that. They wanted to go at 70 degrees. And the reason for it, if you look at, again, the globe, a lot of Russia, northern Russia, the present path of the ISS never goes near it. Gets up close, gets up to around 51.6 degrees, and then starts going, then the inclination changes again, and goes back over the equator, you know, to the south at 51.6, over and over again. So, they want to make it 70 degrees so that they could have it go over more of their land. I don't see how they're going to do that. That kind of a change would create, you know, you need a lot of gunpowder to change degrees. I believe the shuttle, when it was in orbit, if they were off by 3 degrees, that's it. That's what, as far as that they could change. They couldn't go 4 degrees. They couldn't make a 4-degree change. So how they're going to do this, I'm not sure, unless they're going to send them a big rocket. But we'll have to see what they're going to do. Maybe they'll just leave it where it is. But there is a plan, a future for this space station, and the Russians have it. China has a plan for their space station. They're going to deorbit Tiangong 2 very shortly. They don't want another repeat disaster with Tiangong 1, having the whole world wonder where their space station is going to come down. That's what happened with their first space station. The second one that's up there now, it's got two parts now. It's twice as big. They plan on deorbiting that, burning it up over the Pacific Ocean properly. They have plans for Tiangong 3. Next year they plan on launching one of the first modules for that. And that will lead to their permanent space station. I think they plan on having 5 modules eventually attached to it. With no partners, just China. So, that won't be a 6-man crew. That will probably just be 3 men. And at some point, they said it will be abandoned. They'll leave it and then come back to it. And we'll be able to work autonomously without a crew there. So they won't need to leave people on board 100% of the time. But we don't do that with the ISS. Okay, another topic I've covered a number of times is by Virgin Orbit. Virgin Orbit is a spin-off of Virgin Galactic. It's really the same company. But Virgin Orbital is developing a launching rocket that will attach to the bottom of a 747. And this has been under development for quite a few years. And they have their 747. It used to be a Virgin plane. You know, they have Virgin Airlines. They took one of their 747s, they called it Cosmic Girl, they gave it a name, and they plan on attaching not a solid booster rocket, but a liquid powered booster. It's going to have RP-1, that means kerosene fuel, just like a lot of the rockets that launch today, like SpaceX, and it's going to be a two-stage system. So it's different than what Orbital ATK has been doing for many, many years. They've launched many rockets like this from an aircraft. They launched from the L-1011. I think they're up to 43 launches over the decades. And they launched a Pegasus rocket, and that's a solid booster rocket. So I don't see too much of a problem with that, but this thing's a liquid booster rocket. I'm not sure how they're going to do this. You have to chill keep the oxygen chilled down. You're going to need some kind of equipment on board this 747 to keep everything going. They claim they have enough insulation where it's going to be stable, but as you know, you can't just close off the valve and on liquid oxygen, you'll wind up building up too much pressure and the thing will explode. So they'll have to have constant bleed off, and they usually have replenishment going on. I don't know how they're going to do that in a 747, but apparently they have a plan. Or it's called Virgin Orbital. And the the weight of the satellites they plan on launching is in the, you know, 500-600 pound class, so it's good-sized satellites. And they've got many, many contracts already signed to do this. So it looks like their first launch is coming up in a couple of months, and that's why I bring it up. It's called Macho 1. Macho 1 will be attached to the bottom of the 747, the wing of a 747, the port side wing. And they're gonna have fuel for the plane and on the right-hand side to balance it off. So I'm not sure. I guess they're going to have some kind of feed-through pumps, because after they drop this massive rocket from the airplane, you know, I guess they're going to have to send the fuel back to the other side to balance off the weight of the plane. I'm not sure how they're going to do this. A lot of details are missing. It's a private company. NASA does things, you know, they release all the information. It's public knowledge, you know, we're paying for this. But in this case, it's a private company. They can build this thing the way they want it. And, I mean, I'm glad to get some of the information out of it. It's a two-stage rocket. Eventually, they got plans on sending small satellites up to geosynchronous orbit with this thing. Net 1, I call it. I think it's called Net 1, is the one that's going to launch hundreds, if not thousands, of satellites into space. They've already signed up with Virgin Orbital to do, I think, 30-some-odd launches. So they have a big manifest ready to go. And one other topic. I've talked about the removed debris satellite. That was launched by SpaceX to the International Space Station in the trunk of SpaceX. SpaceX Dragon has this trunk, and all kinds of satellites and equipment can go in the back of it. So after it births with the International Space Station, the robotic arm could grab the satellites and, you know, either put it on the International Space Station or deploy it or whatever they're going to do with it. In this case, they deployed it. They finally deployed it. It's been up there like a month, and the removed debris satellite. It's a demonstration satellite, mostly built by a European Space Agency. That's going to show three different technologies on how they could possibly go up to debris and take this debris and eventually deorbit it. So NASA finally launched it from the space station. It's the biggest thing that they've ever launched from the space station. And the first thing that they have is this net. They're going to launch a little tube satellite out away from the main satellite. And this net is going to shoot out and wrap around it. They want to see if they could do this. Wrap around it and see if they could actually pull it back in. So they're going to try the net, and then they're also going to try a harpoon system. They're going to send out like a little target. This arm is going to go out about, I think, about 30 feet. And then they're going to launch a harpoon, and they said it's 22 meters per second, which is like, you know, 70 feet per second. This harpoon is going to shoot out from this main satellite, and it's going to hit this target and see if it could penetrate it and be able to pull it back in. It's not going to be disconnected from the satellite itself. They don't want to do that just yet. They just want to see if they could actually harpoon something and have it penetrate this material and be able to bring it back in. It's material that would be normally found on the outside of a satellite. The third one is, now after they pull in this test piece with the harpoon, they pull in the net, and they pull it up close to the satellite, they're going to unfurl it looks like a solar sail, but they're going to put this big sail out, and because the atmosphere is slightly You have atoms, you know, little atoms and molecules up there floating around in space islands. It's not pure vacuum, but it's little rarefied air that's, you know, 300 miles up, or in this case, 250 miles up, will eventually act on this sail to deorbit the whole contraption that was launched by the International Space Station the other day. And it will slow it down eventually and burn up in the atmosphere. They said by doing it this way, they think they'll be able to burn it up in a couple of days, where if they don't do it, it would take like a month or two before this the satellite would actually deorbit. So three different technologies, and it's all it's actually underway now. So I'll be able to probably report on its success or failure next week or the week after that. Let me drop it to WS2N. Mars rover, not Curiosity, but Opportunity, is one of the rovers that have been riding around on Mars since 2004. So here we are, 14, 15 years later. This thing is still riding around on solar panels. Solar panel power. So it generates around 140 watts, and it usually does that about 3, 4, 5 hours when the sun is really strong overhead on the Mars. On the Mars surface. So they usually get around 400 watts per day. And they're charging two batteries. They have two lithium batteries. Each battery is roughly 8 amp hour batteries. So you got a 16 amp hour battery riding around on this Opportunity rover. Problem is, there's a big dust storm right now. I talked about this last week. It's covering the whole planet now. Last week it was covering the size of the United States and Russia combined. Now it's completely gone all the way around the whole planet, but it's darkest where Opportunity is. It's not going to bother the other rover, Curiosity, because that thing is not solar powered, it's nuclear powered. It has an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. But this one here has solar panels. So the last pictures it took, which was a couple of weeks ago, it's dark. It looks like nighttime. So it's gone down to like where no communications are going on, no science is going on. And in fact, they're worried that by the time the dust storm is over, that Opportunity might not be able to call home. So, what's going to happen is they're going to wait, and the rover is programmed to just eventually go down to its clock. It won't even bring up its CPU. Just the clock itself ticking away. And then usually every solar day, which is a little longer than 24 hours, I think it's 24 hours, 40 minutes, the clock wakes up the CPU and tells it to look to see, look at the voltages, look at the amperages, of, what's in the batteries, and if it's still no good, it shuts itself down again for another day. So this has been going on day after day after day. It could eventually get to the point where the clock doesn't run. I've been trying to figure out how long this is going to run. I've been trying to do the math, but failed at it because, you have to know how many amps do you really need, or how many microamps do you need to run a digital clock, and, I don't have that information. But I do have the amount of amp hours. The battery started out with, there's two batteries, and it's a total of 16 amp hour batteries. And the voltages are 28 volts. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you had a certain amount of micro amps running this little clock, how many days or weeks could it last? Because there's a possibility that this dust storm could last, they said, a month or more. So could this thing operate for 30 days? I don't know. They also said that even if this clock completely ran out, when the batteries start to get recharged from the sun, there's a possibility that it might come back to life because the batteries themselves would start to actually start running the clock, the clock again, and at that point the robot wouldn't know what time of day it is, but it would also start to call home, whether it was day or night. And then NASA at JPL in California would be able to transmit up proper information, tell the robot what day it is, what time it is, and maybe eventually get back to science. Okay, and that's pretty much it. One other topic where we could let that go for now. That's pretty much it. Anybody else have any questions? I know John wanted to talk about the giant wheel that we never built, but it is possible. With that giant wheel, you could actually create gravity. But if not, any other questions? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet.
When it comes to calculating the rate at which the clock can discharge the battery sample, some clocks only require a couple of microamps to run, and that would lead you into a great big number of hours if the batteries had started or fully charged. I wonder if they know what the current rate of charge, the current state of charge of those two batteries is. But the possibility exists that the internal leakage of the battery itself might be considerably greater than the microamps drawn by the clock. Do we know, before this dust storm occurred, what was the state of charge of the two batteries? And are the solar panels aimed in a direction that maximizes sunlight with or without the dust on them? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, Opportunity is just, I believe, south of the equator. So, it's close. I think it's maybe 10, 15, 20 degrees, no more than that, from the equator. So there's no problem. They probably have the panel directly pointing at the sun, knowing that the dust storm was coming. And it was getting larger. I believe they noticed it in early May. So I'm sure they did that. The average was around 400 watts per day that they were getting into it. So if they stopped operations, and let's say they went a week or even 2 weeks before the dust storm really got bad, maybe they, without driving around or doing anything, no science, not drilling any holes. Maybe they got those lithium batteries up to full charge, which would give them, there's supposed to be two 8 amp batteries on this thing, 8 hour amp batteries. You got 28 volts, and who knows, if it's micro amps that they're using, maybe they could go like a month or two.
Microamps on a 16 ampere hour battery drawing some microamps, it might be considerably longer than months of pull. And I'll do a quick calculation on that. So I'll assume 10 microamps. In fact, 10 microamps is a hundredth of an amp. Let me think about that. No. Wow. It's a small fraction of a thousandth of an amp. We're good for a thousandth of hours of pull if the clock only requires microamps, if nothing else is running. Back to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, the problem is they do supplement the electronics inside. They have little heaters in there. They have small plutonium heaters. Each one is like the size of an eraser, and each one is each one is delivering around 1 watt of temperature heat, you know. So it's a total of 8 watts inside the web, inside the warm electronic box to keep the electronics warm. So 8 watts to do that, and it's just not enough because Mars really gets cold at night. So they have electrical heaters inside to come on and off. That eats up a lot of power. When they're actually doing something, driving or drilling, you know, drilling into rocks or something, the electronics are on inside the warm electronic box, so that helps supplement the heat. The only good point of this whole dust storm is it creates a situation where even at night, you're only going to go down to, they said, minus 20 when the drop is. Minus 20 or minus 30 instead of these minus, you know, 100 numbers that they normally do. Because of the heavy dust, the heat that gets absorbed in the ground during the day radiates, therefore, slowly away. You know, it's like here on Earth. If you don't have a cloudy night, you're going to have a very cold night because the heat's going to radiate very quick. If you have a cloudy day, it's kind of like putting a blanket around the planet.
Are they able to estimate whether or not they're getting any charge at all out of the solar cells during this dust storm? There's got to be some light getting through, unless the dust is an inch thick. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's like talcum powder, but it goes up. I believe they set up to 30 miles high, way up there. And it's so dark. They had pictures. I saw a picture on NASA, and they had multiple days. It looked like about 8 days in a row that opportunity took a picture of the sun day after day after day. By the time you got to the last picture, you couldn't even see the sun. It looked like a little star, and that was, you know, 12 o'clock in the afternoon. So. And it went from, you know, one picture to the next picture, all the way down to zero. I think the picture after that they took probably didn't come out because it ran out of power. It's designed to shut itself down. The program is set that, you know, if it does stop even the clock, like I said before, the batteries will start eventually come back to life, they hope, and start making things work. So the clock is not running anymore. You wouldn't know what day or time it is. The batteries could start sending messages to the transmitter to transmit either back up to Opportunity or directly to Earth.
It seems like once before there was a heavy dust storm and all of a sudden a heavy wind came along and blew away all the dust. Too bad Opportunity doesn't come equipped with a dust brush. Over to you, Paul.
I doubled. I kind of like unkeyed for a second. Something about a dust brush. They don't have a dust brush. They hope the wind, and it's worked many times. The wind blows the panels off, completely clear sometimes. I saw one report where they were down to like 300, 310 watts during the day, and then this wind came by, and in one case, an actual dust devil came by. Completely cleared off the panel. They showed pictures of it, and it went right back up to 400 or 500 watts.
Very nice. Sure wish they had equipped it with a dust brush, though. Who do you pull?
Yeah, I know. You know, this guy, who was the Squires, Steve Squires, he was in charge of these rovers, the MER rovers. Spirit and Opportunity, and he was on TV a lot, and he did a heck of a job, and he never thought it was going to go this long. It was designed for 3 months, you know, 90-day operation, and here we are. Well, Spirit lasted 6 years, and this thing is now up to 14, going on year 15.
We certainly got our money's worth. Have they cut back the staff that's maintaining it, Paul?
No, I don't know. You have a driver. Not that he's, you know, driving it. He's sending the information up. The rover evaluates the information and then does whatever it's told, you know, later on in the day or the next day. So you need that. And then you would need people, of course, that are going to read the information that comes back and then pass it on to the scientists. So I don't know how many people are employed in doing, you know, working with Opportunity. And then there's another group working with Curiosity. And then in a couple of years, 2 years from now, let's see, beginning of 2021 is when our next rover will be landing, the 2020 rover, which they haven't given a name yet to it. They call it the 2020 rover because that's when it's going to be launched, but it's going to land in 2021.
And if I understand correctly, that one contains a lot heavier, a lot more serious chemical analysis hardware on board. It's a real chemical laboratory, so that it stands a chance of sending, of detecting the early ingredients of life. Is that true, Paul, T2RIW?
Yeah, it's more advanced than Curiosity. And it's got a couple of other strange experiments on board. One of them is the helicopter. That's going to be interesting. We talked about that on the net. It's going to be mounted underneath the rover. They'll drop that off, move away from it, and the thing will take off and eventually take pictures, send it back to the rover, and the rover will send it back up to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and then back to Earth. That's one thing. And another thing I like is this MOXIE unit. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's a piece of machinery attached to the rover that's going to take the gases from Mars and process them and heat them and whatever it's going to do, and then eventually create oxygen out of this. I forgot the chemical system. I think they're going to use take the carbon dioxide from the air, from the atmosphere, and somehow strip away the carbon and just leave oxygen. And they know that, you know, the system per day would be able to generate enough oxygen, I think, for one person to breathe for an hour or something like that. Some complicated scheme. Which means if you have a crew up there, you know, you'll probably need a machine, you know, the size of a Humvee or something to make oxygen all day long, you know. A big MOXIE machine. So that's interesting. That will be on the next rover. And then also sample return system. They're going to fill up these. They look like good-sized test tubes with different materials with that rover. And then they're going to leave it off, you know. We're going to leave it here, leave it there. And then the rover's going to drive away. And sometime years from now, when they decide that they're going to come up with a sample return mission, let me drop it, they want the option to land in the same place that the 2020 rover lands in. And they want to be able to send another rover out, pick up these samples, bring it back, put it inside the launch vehicle that has just landed on Mars, send that up to the mothership, and then have that spacecraft come back and bring that back to Earth and land it in Utah, in the desert of Utah. An actual plan. They're going to be doing this. The first part of it anyway. The Mars 2020 rover will have these, I'm calling them test tubes, that they're going to be filling up. And then if they want to bring them back, and somebody has enough money to divide the system, that's what they plan on doing. A sample return mission. Back to you there.
The MOXIE that can extract oxygen from the atmosphere on the 2020 rover can give you, I think you said, 1 man-hour's worth of oxygen per 24 hours. Roughly how big is that that particular one right now, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, it's located inside the, or, you know, it's part of the rover. So, I mean, the pictures that they had of it, I don't know, it looked like the size of a gallon of milk, I guess. You know, it wasn't a big unit, you know, but that, you know, it's going to pick up the power from the rover. You know, it doesn't have its own power supply. That I would add to it if it was, you know, individual. But yeah, it's not all that big. And I guess they must have some kind of a sensor or something to figure out if there's really oxygen in this tank that they're going to store it in. You know, there's no way to test it. We can't breathe it. So my guess is they have some kind of spectrometer that's going to look at it.
The sample in return on the 2020 rover, what are they going to be bringing back to Earth? What are they bringing back that has any value, Red?
Well, they say it, like, just Curiosity and the other rovers, you know, they're like little laboratories. But what they're doing and testing, they could test for, you know, a lot better. Higher resolution of whatever they would normally do. If they had actual materials come back to the lab, that's the goal, you know. So if you could collect, well, they're actually going to make core samples. Right now, Curiosity is drilling holes. It takes powder and puts it into the SAM unit or the chem unit. There. Units on board Curiosity evaluate what the stuff is, and then they figure out, you know, is there, you know, organics in there, or, you know, was there water present at one time? That's what they do now. The new one is going to have that capability as well, but it's going to have one more thing. It's going to have like a core boring apparatus, so you'll be able to take little core samples and take those core samples, store them. That's what they would like to bring back. And, you know, I guess the scientists would love to get a hold of something like that, and they're able to figure out more stuff if they bring it back to Earth than doing it, what they call in situ on the planet itself, you know. That's their goal. But you'd have to talk to the scientists to figure out, you know, is this really worth it? Don't you know enough about the rock itself when you evaluate it on Mars? Apparently not. Okay, Dick, I did have one other quick topic. An update on the Unity spaceship. Unity Spaceship 2, they call it. And this one's by Virgin Galactic. Same company I was talking about that will be launching the rocket from the bottom of the 747, Launcher 1, they call that. But this is Unity. This is the one that they're going to put people in. It's not going to go into orbit. It's going to do suborbital flights. It's going to go above the Kármán line. And they got another step closer to it. I know I talked about it about a month and a half ago. They got up to about 100 some odd thousand feet. They broke the sound barrier, and they were happy about that with their rocket-powered engine. Two people were on board Unity, and it's separated from the White Knight 2. White Knight 2 has got the carrier jet. It's got four jet engines attached to it, and it's more or less a second iteration of White Knight 1. White Knight 1 was another carrier that would carry the original spaceship up, and which was much smaller, and that had propellers on it. Well, this thing has four jets, so it brings up the spacecraft like 40,000 feet and drops it, and then this one motor comes on, this one motor rocket. It uses like a rubber for a fuel and nitric oxide for an oxygen. had nitric oxide, you know, just laughing gas. And then this thing points straight up, and it broke the sound barrier. Now, that was 6 weeks ago. They did another test the other day, and the exact same system. But this way, this time they were able to, you know, keep the rocket on a lot longer, and they almost got the Mach 2. It was Mach 1.9, so almost twice the speed of the sound, and much higher in their altitude, but not above this common line yet. Once they do that, and they think they will, they'll be able to test it with the same two pilots. After that, they'll be able to start selling tickets. And we talked about the tickets at like $250,000 each. I found out there's 700 people that have already put their money down for this ride into a suborbital flight. So that was pretty amazing. 700 people. Last time they got up to 114,000 feet it was. So they got to get up to, I think, 330,000 feet. So they have to, like, triple that height to make this viable. And then they're going to start taking passengers. One of the first passengers on board is going to be Richard Branson. He's got, like, the first ticket. He's going to go on the first flight when it's ready to go. So I'm dying to find out what happens with this. It might be the first time we can get somebody into space, even though it's not orbital. Since the, you know, from Earth, from here, you know, American soil, since the retirement of the shuttle Atlantis in 2011. After the final test flight in California, Mojave Desert, I think they got five more left. They're going to certify it and say it's ready for flight. And then they're going to bring this thing to New Mexico. It's called the Spaceport America. Spaceport America. It's a big spaceport that's been built. Nobody's really been using it. I think a couple of small companies have tested a couple of small rockets there. But he signed up to go there. And so that's where you would go. He would bring you $250,000, go there a day or two early, and practice for whatever you're going to do, and then go on this flight on the White Knight 2. Get dropped from 45,000 feet, shoot up to suborbital space, have about 3 or 4, maybe 5 minutes of weightlessness, and return on a runway. And if it becomes a big hit, he's got two more of these things that are in his factory that he's making. He's developing two more of these space vehicles. So how about that, Dick? Back to you. K2RI WWS2I.
Ed Branson is a brave guy. Serial number one that's capable of getting up to the right altitude to call it space. He's going to be on serial number one. There's a lot of things that you and I wouldn't want to be on the very first one until all the bugs are out of us. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, I can car. When I was younger, put me on anything. Not now, though. That's the problem with starting to know too much about this stuff. You start to think about it. The first flight, you know, 6 weeks ago, I saw that, you know, he put that on the computer, on the internet. And that went up straight. I mean, that thing didn't rock at all, you know, it didn't go left, right. But this one, I noticed it was rocking left, right. You know, to me it looked a little unstable, but the report came back, this is the way it's supposed to be. But that first flight, it was steady as a rock. That thing wasn't, you know, rocking, you know, at all. The left wing and the right wing, you know, they were just stable. But this thing here looked like it was going a little bit. So I thought it was a problem, but I don't know, everybody on the ground was clapping. Back to you, Dick.
What you were watching, was that a YouTube video? And if so, what was the search word? Virgin Atlantic orbital number one or something like that?
I would put in Unity Spaceship 2. Unity Spaceship 2. Last flight, you know. So you would see that. Let me see. I believe that you should put the date down because you know what's going to happen. The one from 6 weeks earlier might show up. Or you could watch that one too. I would put the date down. Put down May 29th, 2018. I think you're better off doing that. Because the last one was, like 50 days.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And actually, VSS Unity, that's the official name. Capital of V, S, capital S, capital S. VSS Unity. Any one of those things, you'll find it here. YouTube on it. Well, I'm not even sure if it was YouTube. You know, you'll find a site for it. I clicked on it. It probably is YouTube, but I don't know.
At the rate he's going, he will be operational, what's your guess, 6 months from now?
I believe, the article I read, it said, you know, a couple of months from now, but I don't think so. I'm going to say 6 months from now, but the article was, you know, a couple of months away. You know, I think the people are getting anxious. They want to, you know, get on this thing. You know, he is a brave character. He was the guy that got onto that balloon. I mean, he went on with another guy. It was the two other guys. It might have been, I think it was either one or two other guys, and they went on this balloon ride all the way around the world. That's the same guy. You know, this guy sticks his neck out.
I'm amazed that 700 people have signed up and apparently put down a deposit. You and I speculated that a lot of people would be dropping out after that last failure. And you got 700. Wow. And I think you've told me what the final price was. Run that by again, Paul. What's the current charge to go to space, K2RW?
Years ago when we were talking about this before, you know, you had this, the first one was called Enterprise, and that one crashed and killed somebody. It was $200,000, but now this article, you know, claims it's $250,000 to, you know, I believe they're going to have two pilots and six people go up one time. I think that's the deal. And now this flight here, they duplicated having more seats, you know. The first flight didn't have, you know, I think they just had the pilot, co-pilot, and one seat in the back. And now they put all the seats in the back as, you know, people were sitting there. So, and then, you know, you see an inside view, and the pilot looks like he's moving that wheel, you know, it's a steering wheel. You know, I would think it would be, like, rock steady, but it looked like he's steering it, you know. It starts out a beautiful shot of this thing attached to the White Knight 2 taking off. You know, a rear view of this thing going down the runway. It's really cool looking. Nice blue vehicle. Very well done. It's got these round portholes in it all over the place. And that's what people are going to look out the window. Back to you.
I remember those round portals. It's a weird looking vehicle. Under normal circumstances, a window is a lot weaker than the rest of the spaceship, so you think you would limit the amount of windows. And I guess, by some magic, each of the six passengers are going to have a window close to them that gives them a good view. That would be required. I mean, if I go to space and I get all of the weightlessness, but I don't get a simultaneous good view, I'm going to be disappointed of you, Paul.
Okay, very good. Now, this guy, you know, I agree, but they are round windows, and, you know, a round window is stronger than a rectangular window or a square window. So at least he's got that right. Not like the other guy. It was Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin. You know, he's the guy with, he's got the spaceship. It's called New Shepard, and he's got the spacecraft itself attached to the booster. got nothing in it, you know. And I think he's going to fly like six people at a time in that with no pilot. You know, just get in and, you know, bolt yourself down and we're going to launch to space and the rocket below you is going to separate and that's going to come back down and land vertically. The rocket's going to land vertically in Texas somewhere, by the way. That's where that takes place. And you're going to be with five other people with no pilots flying away into the black sky. And then you're going to come back down with a heat shield. Parachutes are going to open. I think it's three big blue parachutes. Let me drop it. And then you're going to come down, and right before you hit the ground in the Texas desert, these little retro rockets, well, the little retro rockets are going to fly. Right before that, I think the heat shield blows off. So then it's going to expose these little retro rockets. It's going to come, you know, it's going to come down like the Russians. And then you're going to land supposedly, I don't know, 5 miles an hour or something. That's going to be your impact.
A completely automatic vehicle, a computer pilot, no real pilot on board. Wow. What's the price of that particular spaceflight pole, Grant?
Yeah, he said he hasn't released the prices. He's going to start selling tickets in a couple of months. That's the latest on New Shepard. That's the name of the spacecraft and Blue Origin. But Blue Origin, you know, I mean, they're a serious company. They just built this massive building down in Florida. They're almost finished with it, and that's what they're going to start producing there. New Glenn rockets are, I mean, it's not as big, but it's awfully close to the same size as a Saturn V rocket. And he wants to launch his first rocket from Launch Complex 36 in Florida in 2020. So he's got serious... his idea of space is very serious right now. And, you know, he's the richest guy in the world, so I guess he could do it. But he hasn't launched anything into orbit yet.
Would you, as a passenger, feel comfortable going to space with something that has no pilot on board, nothing but passengers?
No, that's two trips I want to take. I want to... I would want a pilot because, you know, I believe that's the reason the 747s fly properly, you know, it's because it has a pilot and a crew. And not to mention it's all the people that are sitting on the plane saying, please keep it here, please keep it here. But to do away with the pilot, you know, let's take the pilot out of the equation on a 747. How many people are going to get into that plane? Just looking around at each other, praying that this thing's not gonna go down, and knowing that it's being flown by, you know, somebody on the ground that, you know, that pre-programmed it to fly from New York to L.A.
And you could program a message into the computer that goes over the PA system. This is a perfect computer. It never makes any errors. Doesn't sound good to me. This was TechNet number 1705 of a series that began September 1982. You've just heard Space Report number 305. Before that, you heard the Science and Physics Report number 305. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. 73 you all. Bye-bye for now. Over to over to Roy for any final comments. AC2GS. K2RIW. Thank you, Roy, and back to you.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, Paul. I don't think I've done this for 305. It might feel like it, but I think it's something like 35. But anyway, I want to thank everyone for participating, and we'll be back to do it again next week. Once again, the email address to contact me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the links to all the stuff that I talk about can be found by just typing in your web browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And if Kay is still listening, I took a look. Apparently, there's a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which astronomers use to date things. It's a function of stars based on their luminosity and their temperature, and by figuring the stars in globular clusters and the what they call the main sequence turnoff stars, they can date them to into the billions of years. So that's how they know that those globular clusters are as old as they are. So thank you, everyone. Have a great week, and hopefully we'll all be back here to do it again next week.
AT2RY, listening.
The time is 12:04 a.m., 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
system.
Back to you on the output. I got the microwave working. K6DPZ cleared.